Okay, can I ask people to find some seats? We have seats. This is everybody here is a Methodist. Nobody's sitting in the front row. I mean, that's the way it is back home. Welcome. We're glad you're here. We're very happy to have you all here. This is going to be really interesting, and I'm just very, very pleased that one of my bosses, Bill Frist, is one of my bosses. I'm also finding out he's about bossed about half of the people in the room. I mean, he can't resist saying yes to helping needy NGOs, and so I'm just one of the great beneficiaries of this generous human spirit that he has and brings to everything. I first met, of course, I'd seen Senator Frist from a distance, but we first met back in 2001 when, through Steve Morrison's efforts, we held a conference on the Sudan. This was trying to create a new political dynamic in the Sudan to try to create a peace structure in Sudan. It's not, by the way, it's a job that's not finished yet. Mm-hmm. But, and at that time, we held a conference, I remember this so vividly, because we held it at the Holocaust Museum, intentionally, to highlight what was going on in Sudan. And the key and lead speaker for that was Senator Frist. And it was a courageous step then, because the battle lines politically were drawn in the United States as well. And he decided to create new space here so that we could create new space in Sudan. And it was, I'll never forget that. It was the first time I had a chance to meet this man and to see the content of his character. And it was a wonderful experience. And then from that, we pulled up our courage and asked if he would be willing to co-chair our HIV/AIDS program, and he did. He and Senator John Kerry were the first co-chairs, and that then led to PEPFAR, probably one of the most important innovations and certainly one of the most dramatic foreign policy innovations during the last 10 years, and it was through his very direct involvement. And it's just the first of a long legacy of our having a chance to work with Bill Frist. When he did leave public life, he was called, I think, 2 nanoseconds after the announcement came out and asked if he would consider joining our board, and he did, and I'm so very pleased for that. But he didn't approach it as a, you know, some people join boards like this just so it's another trophy on the wall, you know. But it's not a trophy on the wall. He then took the lead to help us build this new global public health program that we have here that Steve is heading up. So this is a man that in every step of the way has been an active leader to change the world. And change the world for the better. And we are very grateful for that. Could I ask people to turn off their phones, by the way? We would like to be able to enjoy this conversation today. About his book, this is his seventh. No, you've written, is this eight or seven?
That's seven.
This is
seven.
No, he's only written 6 other books, okay? And this is number 7, and he's got 2 more in the works. So, right? And I asked him, I said, well, do you have a ghostwriter? He says, no, but I'm looking for one. So someone who's been able to write 7 books, over 100 academic articles, and still be the majority leader and still be so active in now a great new cause. And it's the cause of bringing health to the world, both because it is important in itself and also for what it does for retooling America in the world. It's been a real privilege to work with Bill Frist. And we asked if we could host this event. He's going to have several in Washington. We asked if we could host this event as a very small way to say thank you to a great man who's done a lot of good for this country and for the world. And we're looking forward to this session. Thank you very much.
John, thank you. Great to be here. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for joining us on this happy occasion where we're really here to celebrate the launch of Senator Bill Frist's work, A Heart to Serve, which we we have in the back, and will be available later in this event. It's a moment. It's always a moment of joy to see the completion of a book by a friend and someone that you admire and know. And this is one of those moments. And what's special here about this book? We'll be hearing more about that. But it's one which looks at the arc of one's life, which is a pretty remarkable life, and attempts to identify a number of continuous threads and themes over the course of that. And it's been a pretty hectic and fast-moving pace that you're covering in the course of this life. We'll be having a conversation for the next 20 or 30 minutes, the two of us, and then we'll open it for to engage all of you. I want to, before we begin, offer special thanks to Jenny Dyer and Ellen Williams from Centers Frist's staff for their support and help in putting this together, and from CSIS, the many people who've contributed to make this possible: Russ Oates, Neil Erwitz, Daniel Porter, Emily Poster, Seth Gannon, Maria Rehoff. A few themes come across from this book. One is the continuity and the consistency with the emphasis on service, on making service a component part of one's life in many different settings and in many different applications, always with passion and conviction. And we see this in the accounts throughout the book, as a student, as a family member, as someone living on Bowling Road in Nashville, as a doctor, as a humanitarian activist in Sudan, and as a civilian, as a citizen legislator, which is a term that keeps popping up over the course of this book. And I think we'll hear more from Senator Frist about what that means. But it's in that setting, as a citizen legislator, that he ascended into the majority leader's position with considerable impact. A second big theme that comes across is the continuous abiding commitment and interest in health. No matter what the phase is, it's a dominant theme. And it has a heavy moral obligation, a heavy moral point to it, where you make the case repeatedly about the obligation that to confront the 46 million uninsured, the obligation to confront the gross inequities that we confront, that we face globally in terms of poverty and a lack of affordable access within our own borders and outside to the kind of key essential services and medications that make life prosperous and stable. One last big theme that comes across is that lucky breaks really matter. Senator Frist talks about the accidental entry into political leadership at Princeton when called upon suddenly to debate the ROTC presence on campus, and that a bell went off. The 1994 revolution in our own Congress, in our own electorate, was a key moment at which you appeared and entered the Senate and made that big transition from heart and lung transplant leader to suddenly being in the U.S. Senator. The ascent into heading up the National Republican Senatorial Committee in 2001, that was not preordained. That happened, and for a variety of reasons, with sudden passage of Senator Coverdell, Senator Abraham leaving the Senate, and that became a formative moment in changing the power base of the Republican Party in the Senate, and really moved you into a much different position. When the crisis around Senator Lott and the leadership appeared thereafter, it was another big moment where it was not preordained that we would see you as the majority leader, but you became that. So with those broad framing remarks, what I'd like to do is move through a series of questions. Let's start, Bill, with the first question, which is the basics. What is this book that we have? Why did you write it? And what's the audience you're trying to reach? And if I'm a reader fresh to this book, when I'm done with it, how am I going to be changed and moved by this book?
Steve, first of all, thank you everybody for being here. It's fun for me, so many friends who are with me, but also to give the opportunity to talk a little bit about the why here. John Hamry and the work with CSIS, we'll come back to the importance of us sort of as a big team, Washington, D.C., public sector, private sector, working together around this greater good. It's very much the theme of this book. But it is interesting because usually people write books all sorts of reasons. But in Washington, usually people write books if they're running for something. I ain't running for anything. We'll get that out there. I'm not running for governor, president, vice president, cabinet position. I'll say that because usually people kind of want to ask that. It's not the purpose. It's also not, Steve, it's not a political memoir mm-hmm. of sort of a has-been politician or wannabe politician. It's not that. And it's interesting because Washington, that's the first thing they want to pick up the book. And so what is it? I think you caught it in terms of walking through this. What are the consistent themes, and not my life, could be anybody's life, that start around service, that continue in ways that start in family and in college in certain ways, but then in medicine, in this healing profession for 20 years, where I had the opportunity to dream and dream big, and people would say, no, you can't dream, and I'd have to move to other states to sort of capture those dreams, to run into pioneers like Norman Shumway who are thinking of solutions to insurmountable problems, innovative, creative solutions are there. So 20 years of that stuff, one-on-one, transplanting hearts, and then losing my mind and running for the United States Senate. Losing my mind. Everybody here knows it. Why in the world would you give up being able to save people day after day? Yeah, I say save. I say, we're the tools. I'm a plumber, really. You know, just changing your hearts around. But why would you give that up? Well, everybody likes you. And come to a town where, by definition, 50% of people are going to hate you all the time. You get mixed up and people question your ethics. But it's the health of a community. No longer the health of one-on-one, it's the health of a community. And that, was for me, was for Tennessee initially. And then in the whole global health, which John Hamry was nice to mention, which through volunteer medical mission trips, working with CSIS, the Millennium Challenge Corporation, Save the Children, Africare, all of these things, it becomes the health of the world. But it's all built around healing. And so the book is called A Heart to Serve because it's service, what you mm-hmm. caught. And then it's the passion, because the message of the book is not all this stuff. It is that all of you, everybody listening, all of us, dig deep in our own selves, find the passions, and then shape those passions in a way that you're serving others to make the world a little bit better. It doesn't have to be heart transplants. It doesn't have to be politics. But that is the underlying message through these stories and the storytelling that's there.
Thank you. There's a pattern that appears early in this book about you deciding to sort of cut your own path in life, as against expectations, as against what your father or your brother or others might have been doing or expecting of you or your wife.
Yeah, that's right.
You pick up karate, you pick up flying, you choose not to go to Vanderbilt, you go to Princeton. You major in public policy while pursuing a pre-medical path. You move in the direction of the heart and lung transplant versus business, and then you move into politics. Tell us a little bit more about that, because that's sort of at the base, it seems to me, of your own personality as you move through life.
Yeah.
This pattern is pretty clear across the book and across your life.
Yeah, it is, and that's nothing I plan out. I don't basically say, here's a road, that's safe and secure, and that's where I should be going, and then take the other road every time.
Right.
On the other hand, some people think that's what I do coming in. And when we go do mission work, we do gravitate to countries where there is turmoil and strife and conflict. And I don't know exactly where it started, but it has to do with risk-taking. Risk-taking in the sense of not inordinate risk, because when I take somebody's heart out and I put somebody's heart in, every second counts, and there are no mistakes, no mistakes, no mistakes, because if there's one mistake, the patient dies. So I take risk knowing that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the risks, to me, are not risks. They're calculated risks. But I do tell a story in the book about a chemistry professor of mine, a mad scientist, like the, flames going everywhere. And I needed that because I didn't like science that much. But so I needed that to be sucked into all this stuff. I loved him. But on his last day of class, Hubert Allier, no longer alive today, this was at Princeton, he basically said just that. He basically said, this is my chemistry professor. What's he know about life and all this stuff? But basically he said, if you do have a choice in life to take the sort of secure, take the safe path, and there's another path out there that you might capture the synergies, the serendipity, and your passions are leading you to go that way, take that other path. And I put it in there because you're exactly right. I don't do the counterintuitive thing, but when running for United States Senate, I did run at a time before we knew 1994 was going to happen. I did choose to run against the incumbent United States Senator who had been there for 18 years, who was going to be the next majority leader of the Senate, as a challenger unknown, when we did have an open race in the state. And people said, you're crazy. Why in the world would you do that? You are crazy. That's what everybody in Washington said. Everybody in Washington said, because you got a 50-50 chance at the time. The seat had opened up because of Al Gore. And that's a good example. But what it took, because I knew that I could outwork. I knew I could start at 6 o'clock in the morning because I do heart transplants. I work 6-7 days a week. Trip Cassell is here in medicine. You just work 7 days a week, and you operate every night. So I knew I could outwork him. And I knew that people wouldn't expect it. A breath of fresh air. Hadn't been a physician in the United States Senate in 68 years against established Washington. So, and I got lucky in 1994. The luck part of all of these stories is there. But I put that in there because there are a lot of people with passions inside that say, I'm going to get beat, and therefore they don't do it, and they don't dream. And to really get these innovative, creative solutions to these big problems out there, we need dreamers and people out there who capture those passions and channel them in an active way, and we just don't see that enough.
Thank you. Let's talk about what you represent with respect to health and health reform, because over the course of this book, it becomes clear that you are a pragmatist, that you believe in the moral imperative that we need to take this on both domestically and internationally, that you're very much in favor of bipartisanship. You overtly come out in support of President Obama's efforts, that you're putting very special emphasis on controlling costs and improving access and preserving the incentive structures to keep the private sector engaged and at the table and actively driving forward. Your experience in Britain seems to have had profound impact on you. Your experience at Princeton, teaching and researching, and now your work at Vanderbilt in trying to put new models together, get the business faculty and students, get the law faculty and students at the table talking about these things. So there's a vision that emerges there that I think sets, there aren't that many people of this, of your profile. I think that in terms of Republican leadership on these issues, you're in a small pool of people that are continuing to push in that domain, and that leadership vision is quite important. Also, you can point to high impact in saying Congress can lead and should lead. The Modernization Act, the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003, the launch of PEPFAR, that these are profound and dramatic historic proof that the kind of vision that you represent actually translates into dramatic impact. So if you could talk a little bit more about that, because
there are a lot of themes, and you mentioned a concept, which I do mention in here a lot, and it is the citizen legislator. And is it kind of gimmicky or kind of an old concept that doesn't apply in Washington today? I don't think so. And that's why, though I'm out of elected politics, I believe in Washington, I believe in our government, I love America, I love the process, and yes, it's messy, but it is the best of the best. But to make it even better, I do think we need to return to the opportunity to bring real people here with real experiences, whatever they are. It might happen to be 20,000 patients, thousands of operations, you know, working hard trying to heal, and coming to a body that had zero medical experience in the United States Senate when I came. Yet, the problem out there that we're seeing today, 18% of our economy, $2.3 trillion, premiums going up 3 times faster than wages. It's better now, but when I came, nobody was here. And why would you come here? And I hope the message in here, in part, for somebody who'd never run for public office, never served in public office, didn't vote for a while when I was out there slugging it out with Tripp in medical school, that you can take somebody like that and playing by the rules, keeping the integrity and the family values and the character, doing your best to, which I talk about in the first third of the book, and come through here and then apply that, which is kind of missing here. When a patient comes in the room, you focus on them, you're patient-centered, nothing else matters, it's nonpartisan, all biases go out, and you focus on them, and you listen carefully, and you make a diagnosis. You don't, sometimes you don't have all the information, but you make a diagnosis, and then you act. And you got to act. You can't just sit here in Washington and not act. And that's why you'll see me. I don't agree right now where President Obama is taking us on these bills, but if I have them out there, but I'm pushing it hard. I'm saying let's get in the room together. Let's make it bipartisan. Mm-hmm. When we did the Medicare Modernization Act bill in here, we had 76 votes coming out of the United States Senate for a bill that neither extreme liked, but it took reaching out. We had 76 votes on a bill that ended up probably $800 billion bill. We're talking about a $900 billion bill in health care, but we had 76 votes. It was bipartisan. Where is that now? So I'm here pushing that. Those are the sort of thematics. And then a willingness to leave. So, I'd make some here for 12 years. I'm mm-hmm. out. People say, you're not out. You've got to stick around here. Or you should stick around here. Or, of course, you are going to stick around here. And I am going to stick around, but not being a leader in the Senate. I'm going to be working through organizations like CSIS and the organizations like AfriCare and Save the Children and the Millennium Challenge Corporation that are truly global. Do the same stuff, kind of what the doctor does. You listen, you diagnose, you treat, and then what's different? You're held accountable. When I lift somebody's heart out and I put a new heart in, I'm with them the rest of their life. And in Washington, the accountability end of things, yes, elections are out there. I talk about all this in the book. The elections are there, but the real accountability of what's going to happen after you mm-hmm. do something, it's just more of a 2-year town instead of a 20-year town. But that sort of thinking of citizen legislator coming in, spending time, going home, living on the laws that are passed.
Now let's turn to some of the more difficult moments that are in this book.
Before we do that, let me just say on the bipartisanship. No, I want to get to that. In fact, I have a chapter on my biggest failure, and we'll get to a couple of them. The things that I think have the biggest impact, the stupidest political mistakes that I made. All of it's written in here. Why did I put those chapters in there? But we'll come to those. But before that, this bipartisan thing, because just so you'll know, and I'm in a partisan position, as being majority leader. And that's where the partisan people need to be. You need to be these leaders. But at the end of the day, you got to be able to shut the door, get back, negotiate, work with the other side. Let me just show you how I'm working at it now. It's a little bit quirky, but this is what I think America is looking for.
Gentlemen, surely the point is that
Democrats have been spreading this far-left agenda for too long, and it's just wrong. Jinx, buy me a Coke.
Right now?
No talking, Jinx rules.
How about it?
Why not?
All right, that's what we need. Tell them to go. Yeah. You know, a lot of has-been politicians is or former politicians, you know, they're kind of searching what to do. That's the, and this is a Super Bowl commercial. It was seen 6 minutes before Super Bowl 3 years ago. It was seen by about 180 million people. It was also used in the Olympics. And people said, why did you do it? Are you going to be a pitch man? Because some of the former politicians get into that stuff. I said, no. In fact, in retrospect, I should have really charged them for this thing because it seems by so many people. But I said, and James did too, is basically said, listen, maybe there is something we can do that can be seen by 180 million people and have an impact, of pulling people together in ways that's unconventional. And that's about the only commercial in life I'll ever do. But it really is this overall message of trying to pull people together. So I have to carry on Coca-Cola. The problem with that is I'm a doctor, and then with all the sugar and Coke, so I can't. You can't win on all of them. Go ahead. All right, but the problem stuff. Let's talk.
So about there were, you know, in this book, we've got three searing experiences that you treat, and these were bruising experiences. They're ones that occurred in the Bush years, where there was an escalation and a polarization around the events and around the decisions, and they're familiar, I'm sure, to those of us who followed what's happened. I mean, there's the your ascent to being majority leader and the sensitivities that surrounded all of that around race and around Trent Lott's exit, the Terry Schiavo case, and as you point out there, the many multiple dimensions to this around accuracy of diagnosis, parents' rights, the perspective of being a physician versus a political leader, states' rights, the individual, and then the HCA stock sale, 18-month-long investigation at the end of your tenure as majority leader. This was a difficult. These were difficult segments, I think, for you to incorporate into the book, and I just thought we needed to turn to them and ask you to say a few words
and
more
it
about
it. If I'd written sort of what most people write, you'd write about the stuff that's not painful and the stuff that sort of makes you look good and you get it out there and history kind of writes it. I chose to take a different technique and basically take the most painful experiences, the political loss, the things that hurt me and my family the most, only to give sort of a reality check to where Washington is and the dynamics that are out there. And I talked about I did a chapter on my ascent to becoming majority leader. How did it happen? What kind of leadership is it? Is it a call to leadership? And I'll just take a couple real quick. On the Lott chapter, and it's not the Lott chapter, it's really the ascent, but I never had talked about it ever. And I wanted to kind of put down just sort of from my perspective. But I say cynics will forever be convinced that I became majority leader of the Senate through collusion with President Bush and his advisors. It wasn't that way. And for those who are fascinated by the inside baseball of Capitol Hill, the story reveals the inner workings of the upper legislative body. And for leadership, I skipped down, and for leadership selection within the body, the complicated personalities, the fierce loyalties, and the deferential respect for the institution and its traditions play a much larger role than outsiders might imagine. And I go on and tell the story of sort of what happened. Again, no confidence. This is not, there's no dirt in this book, so it may not sell well in Washington, but that's okay with me. But it basically tells the story of what leadership is all about, the tensions that are there, the fact that you have 100 people there who are working to do their very best that have both their own passions, their own strengths, their own weaknesses in the story itself. And I do talk about that all of my discussions. I never wanted to be majority leader of the United States Senate. I was coming here for 12 years, and then I'm out of here. And that's not a position, I mean, it's a position of management and good, but it's not a legislative position. And I came here to do stuff, to cut, to sow, to fix problems out there. And I knew once I did that, it would take away from that. And it did in part, although, as you said, HIV, AIDS, PEPFAR, prescription drugs, we got some good stuff in. The Schiavo stuff is really interesting because out of all that stuff that you saw on TV, you never heard me comment once. You never saw me do one press conference ever. It's different than Washington, where people are trying to spin stuff. So I did want to get the story out. But it is when I see people, they say, oh, you made a diagnosis looking at Fox News or whatever it was. And the answer obviously is no. That the court-appointed video that I saw for 6 hours with two other neurologists and four neurologists saw it, two had a conclusion very different than the other two, yet a woman, government, was coming in to kill a woman severely disabled, but where the mother said don't kill her, the dad said don't kill her, the brother said don't kill her, and the sister said don't kill her. All blood relatives said don't kill her. Yet, because it was split vote, 2-2, and ultimately the rule of law, a woman who was not brain dead, severely disabled, a woman who did not have a terminal illness, did not have cancer, you know, usually you so-called pull the plug with cancer, a woman who whose family loved her, and a woman who was no financial cost to anybody because they would pay for her, our government basically took her away. So anyway, the story is in here, which is great, but I'll just read the first paragraph. We all make mistakes in life. Some play out in private, and some play out in the public. Many consider my biggest mistake as majority leader was act on the case of an incapacitated woman in Florida, Terry Schiavo. Looking back politically and publicly, it may have been advantageous to have never addressed the issue. But morally, let me share the full story of what happened, and you can be the judge. I do talk about things that were left out, the fact that brain death is something that I am a professional at. It is something that in the heart, I don't cut somebody's heart out and put it in unless I've diagnosed brain death. I know that stuff. People never mention the fact that I ran the individuals with disability policy for the United States Senate for 2 years. Therefore, individuals with disabilities and their rights are something that I care about. So I put it in there. But it's to me, it's a great story. Politically, probably big mistake. But I can tell you that I go to bed having been the only person in the United States Senate at the time who took an oath, the Hippocratic Oath to preserve life, and another oath to the Constitution, the only person there to protect life and people who can't protect themselves. I go to bed feeling pretty good about it. And then the HCA you mentioned, and this is an interesting one, and for 3 years, don't know why really, but where nothing had been done wrong had the media mainly, and obviously the other side saying, this guy, I've got to take this guy out, made allegations that went on for 2.5 years that really struck at me, because being a doctor, my values of character, my values of family, addressing a company that they knew it would get to me. They knew it would get under my skin, and it did get under my skin, although you never really saw it because I never did a press conference on it, ever. A series of about 150 articles written by the Washington papers and the New York Times perpetuating the allegations for which there was no fact founding, but perpetuating, again, kind of makes good script. And then, of course, when the whole thing was dropped with no information, on page 12, there was a paragraph. Now, so it's an interesting thing. I think Washington needs to think a lot about that. This one paragraph. The most painful episode during my time serving in the Senate was the one that was even more personal. It struck at my family, tore at my spirit, and even caused me for a time to lose faith in our legal system. Lasting for more than 18 months, it cost me and my family personally more than we will ever admit, and explains why many successful people today don't even consider spending a part of their life serving in Washington, D.C. So the stories are in there, and that's about a third of the book, that gives sort of the inside, the realities of where we are today, a call to action to bring people together, and also an unwavering faith in the system itself, and a call to action. And I recruit people to come to Washington, although I'm going to stay in Nashville.
Thank you. I think this is a good point to transition to hear from some of our audience members.
Yeah.
We have microphones. And what I suggest we do is just let's bundle up comments and questions. Keep them very short. Please identify yourselves, and we'll do three at a time, and then we'll come back to Senator Frist. So we have two people right here. Sir.
Hi, Dr. Frist. I'm Adam Garfinkel. I'm the editor of the American Interest, and I have the copy here in which you have an article almost 4 years ago, and I want to ask you about the subject of the article in the magazine. It was about a U.S. health corps that had an expeditionary element to it. And I think you talked a little bit about our hospital ship program and how it would be a good idea to expand it. Now, it's 4 years later. I haven't noticed a whole lot of good things happening as a result of this excellent suggestion. And it seems to me that the reasons for doing this are even more compelling today than they were 4 years ago. Can you tell us a story? Why did this excellent idea not get traction? What can we do to give it traction?
Good.
Thank you. Well, and right behind you?
Go ahead and ask.
Yes, please.
Mine's a bit more political than that. I'm Sam Stein. I'm with the Huffington Post. And a lot of this conversation has been about changing the discourse of Washington and bringing people together around a bipartisan consensus. Wondering if you could talk a bit about the Republican Party. Video surfaced yesterday of Senator Lindsey Graham being confronted by Tea Party protesters, town hall protesters, people who accused him basically of treason. And in a recent survey in your home state of Tennessee, 34% of adults said they believe President Obama was born in another country. I'm wondering if you are worried at all about this type of element surfacing in the Republican Party and what you think the party needs to do to maybe tame it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Let's take a third question or question comment if people are ready. Okay, let's come back. Yes, Ward. Please use the microphone there.
I've known this man for 30-some years, and so I...
Don't tell me those old stories.
My wife gave me some good advice coming in this morning. She said, buy that book only if he explains why you look 10 years older than he does in the book. He has been through more excitement and stress, and worked longer hours than anybody in this room, and he's always done it with great humility and great energy. And so we're very, very fortunate to have him here. But I guarantee you the book will not tell you how to have black hair at age 57.
Trip, you're great. Thank you.
Okay.
Trip and I were in medical school together, so we went to lots of battles and been in Iraq together. He's a great public servant. You want to jump in?
Yeah.
Global health cord, I feel passionately about it. It came from the opening chapter of the book where I talk about about 11 or 12 years ago going to southern Sudan. And the story there is pretty straightforward story. This was when I was United States Senator, and we kept it quiet and still quiet about it, but would fly in, obviously no security. It was a terrorist nation at the time, a lot of fighting. And the Civil War going on, 5 million people had been displaced, 2 million people had died. Went in with a group, faith-based group called Samaritan's Purse, and it was basically me and one other surgeon, and they dropped us off, airplane on the ground for 6 minutes. A lot of fighting going on. The interesting thing is we go back every year, and jumping ahead, you can read the chapter of the book, and what I saw is through medicine, through healing, where you're focused on the individual and you're building trust it's an intimate relationship. It doesn't matter whether you're from America or where you're from. All of a sudden, fighting stopped. And commerce started, and synagogues and churches popped up in schools. And now that one little clinic, we're operating by flashlight. There are some good pictures in the book as well. Us operating by flashlight, there's peace throughout that region. Now, not just because of that. But what it took there was, in this particular case, a volunteer spirit, something that America has, interaction, and the thing that the global end of it, the global health gives of it, a feeling of trust, of being able to reach out and touch people. The problem is we have a shortage now, and we have a huge capacity. So the global health care is something I'm going to continue to push for. I can do it in a little bit different way. The bill that I had on the floor hadn't been picked up by enough people. There are a few people who are picking it up. There are ways. I'm working through Hope Through Healing Hands, my foundation, that go on the website, hopethroughhealinghands.org, where I am matching people and sending them over, let's say, an anesthesiologist from Vanderbilt for a period of time, say 4 to 6 months. And then for the sustainability arguments, we'll train 3 or 4 nurse anesthetists, indigenous, who'll stay on the ground for the next 10 or 15 or 20 years there. That sort of partnering and sustainability, and it could be in Bangladesh, in Latin America, in Africa, is where we need to go. It takes the public sector, it takes the private sector, it takes the public sector to set the framework up. This is going to be the only solution, because we can keep giving money away for pills and all that stuff. But until we have sustainable infrastructure, and it applies mainly to healthcare I'm talking about, but also to other things. And that's where groups like the Millennium Challenge Corporation, I don't want to get in too far into this, but our government has a group called the MCC, the Millennium Challenge Corporation, that your taxpayer money, about a billion dollars. Now Washington's thinking in $1 trillion. That's too much for me. When I was here thinking in billions, $1 billion a year to develop infrastructure, sustainability, to lift people out of poverty. The video I didn't see yesterday about it, I think the bigger question, or the nuance of what you're saying, the Republicans have lost it and are biased and backward. I don't know if that's really what it is, but the 34%, that was for all Tennesseans, the Obama, that's why our voice in having good people here, get facts out, explain to people, communicate with people, get rid of what not Washington but a lot of people have is a certain arrogance, and listen to real people on the ground. When the patient comes in, I don't care where they're from, how much money they have, I spend the time, I communicate, I listen to them, and just get a more educated populace out there. And the NC video, I just didn't see the town meeting song. That's it.
But just to follow on, I mean, do you see yourself playing a leadership role now in reconstituting and reshaping the party itself?
Yeah, let's show that other video that I'll show you. The party itself, yeah, but I'm just not listening. Republicans led on HIV/AIDS. That bill, I'm not sure what happened. I worked with the Democratic leadership on HIV/AIDS, mm-hmm. and it was President Bush who basically came out and said, there's a virus out there, and he hadn't traveled out of the United States, and people didn't have that expectation. But in 2003, he went to the floor of the United States Senate and done what no other president in the world has done. And it's to take on an issue that when I was in practice in 1981, it killed nobody. Nobody. When I was an intern, when Tripp and I were interns, nobody. And we watched 500 people die, and then 500,000, then a million, then 10 million, and 20 million, 23 million. And it took Republican leadership with the Republican Senate to step up and say, we're going to have the single greatest investment in the history of mankind against a single virus. Now, I can brag about that because we haven't done lots of other things coming in. I think the Republican Party right now is going through a reinvention of ideas, a modernization of ideas, and looks like there's going to be a pretty good opportunity here in the near future for that. And yes, I want to be a part of that. I believe strongly in K-12 education out there. As you know, Republicans mm-hmm. haven't traditionally fought for education. I'm running a group called Tennessee Score, TennesseeScore.org, statewide initiative. When you look at what came out here, actually, the D.C. schools are doing a little bit better, but Tennessee is 46th, my state, 46th in the nation on the K-12 education. So I think the Republican Party will look a lot more at education, a lot more at health care as we go through. Let me just show you real quick here. Go ahead and click that, baby. This is just one way of pulling together in a bipartisan way on big issues.
I think that what we've seen is a dramatic change in circumstances in a very short period of time.
That's volume is all we have.
Better health and a real chance at a much better future.
This is the whole global health arena. Yeah, we had huge opportunities.
We want to showcase this success story so that we can energize the American people and people in high levels in government.
This was a video we shot last summer. And you'll notice in the background video is Tom Daschle, John Podesta, Bill Frist, Mike Huckabee, Cindy McCain, all rallying around
their children issue. Are a message to a future that we will not see. We may not see their future, but it's brighter as a result of what's happening here. You can see it on their faces, and you hear it with their stories.
One is a kind of unique campaign that
there's Cindy, Tom,
and Republicans, and citizens.
There's Mike Gerson over on the right, Huckabee on the left.
The country to try to impact
anyway, we don't. I wasn't going to stop there. That's good enough. The whole point of this is that this was right before the conventions. This was before President Obama was clear who was going to be and all. And what we did, building on really the way CSIS and others working, we took a group of people over and the Gates Foundation and the One Campaign funded it. And I think we do have a huge opportunity by working together. And it was demonstrated here under the initiatives that were put forth by Republicans initially, rallied behind by Democrats, that will literally change the course of history. And then when you see this sort of thing and you see how that can work, it wasn't written about. You didn't see on the front page of Washington Post that a group of us 1 month before the Republican convention and the Democratic convention were down there together doing this, the kind of thing. So Washington got to tune into it a little bit more. And the people are willing to do it, but Washington's got to pick it up a little bit. Boy, got to promote it. The media's got to promote it a little bit more aggressively. But when you see this, and you see 2.1 million people alive on antiretrovirals today, all of a sudden, the thematic of this book of health, hope, and healing kind of comes true, because one-on-one, I can do heart transplants and do heart surgery. Oh, that's great. Coming and spending public service in the United States Senate, 7 million people out there, the health of that community, and indeed doing the same sorts of stuff, like that patient coming in the global world, the United States is making a difference. And indeed, in that particular effort has changed the course of history.
Thank you. We have time for one more round of comments and questions. I'll take three, maybe four. Down in front, then Harvey. Yes, please identify yourself.
Samira Daniels. I'm interested you focus on the physical, health and so forth, global health. And I think that one of the things that is sort of left in the, side is the effects of war and the effects of conflict and what it does to the psyche of people and how that has created, alcoholism and drug addiction and so forth. And I just wonder how one can deal with this, given that, the cultural, the ignorance of so many people about the cultures and the tendency to think in stereotypes, how you would deal with those issues.
Thank you.
Good.
Harvey?
Harvey Sloan Center. The PEPFAR program is comparable to the Marshall Plan. And congratulations. That's an incredible achievement that's been made. We're unfortunately seeing 2 million folks every year get infected. The long-term of PEPFAR, we maybe see a little bit of vaccine coming in, but not much.
Yeah.
Where do we go? How can we do some better prevention on this?
Thank you. Down in the back there, Bob.
Morning, Senator Francis. Bob Wells here.
Yeah, Bob.
I wanted to ask your views on how to improve and actually increase the American narrative, looking at what type of capabilities we have in the United States, certainly Vanderbilt University, looking at our capability, our competencies, our people to serve globally. I think that's an important future objective.
Is there anyone else who'd like to? Yes, right in front, and then we'll come back to you and we'll wrap things.
David Oop from Save the Children. I think I know the answer to this question, but I'd like to ask the senator maybe to comment a little bit on what more the U.S. can and should be doing about maternal, newborn, and child health. We've made enormous progress on HIV and AIDS and committed substantial resources, but we've done a lot less on the broader agenda. So
right.
A good comment on
good. Yeah, I'll just run through fairly quickly. In the book, I address it in part in terms of the conflict and the spiritual and almost the everything other than physical aspects. And that's one of the reasons I gravitate to the Congo or the Sudan in Darfur later when we called it genocide. And I pushed that. I talk about it in the book. Our State Department didn't want to call it genocide coming in. And I went to the floor of the Senate, and the next day I was going to the Sudan, and I had my visa ripped out of my hands. So I said, I don't like to ever hear no. So when the visa was ripped out of my hands by the Sudanese government, I called it genocide. This was right before the August recess. They said, you're not coming. They don't like me in Khartoum anyway. And I said, okay. But I knew inside I was coming. So I went down to Nairobi. I took a plane, flew over Sudan, went to the country Chad, and I came across the border, and I was there. So I got there. I think part of the gravitation is that medicine kind of gets it. Medicine, unlike just humanitarian aid or just feeding people and that sort of thing, you really do get to this intimacy, this structure of health, of bringing people up. And that cuts through all the cross-cultural stuff. They don't care. In fact, when I was in the Sudan in the late 90s, I took care of the good guys, and I took care of the bad guys. And when people saw me, the bad guys were real nice to me coming in. But what it did, it broke down through all those barriers. And that's why medicine as a currency for peace, the broader. And that's why this mantra that I use, and again, Ward Cassell's used it when he was with the military and defense, that is so important. And as we look at Afghanistan, as we look at Iran right now, and we look at what General David Petraeus, I do have a good story about Petraeus in here as well, is so important. The Harvey, the next step with PEPFAR, I think it kind of goes to the Save the Children thing. The PEPFAR was targeted. We knew what it took, and we've done great. We've saved lives. Instead of 30, 40 million more people, when we did our first CSIS study, which preceded PEPFAR, it was John Kerry and me. Bipartisan CSIS, it wasn't government, people weren't paying attention, and we got out and we worked it. And then sort of we weren't responsible for it, although the bills that he and I wrote became the foundation of the PEPFAR legislation. It's going to have to go to infrastructure. It's going to have to go to systems development, because no matter how many vaccines, and the vaccine is the long ball. It's probably not going to happen. Not going to happen. So that's not where our focus will be. So it has to be where my emphasis is on hope with hope through healing hands, on healthcare systems itself, on this human capital. It really goes to Bob's issue about people, competency, get the best of the best, not just the academies, but I would say the corporate world, even though Washington right now doesn't like the corporate world, get the very best of the best of the corporate world, of the private sector that's out there. capture the grassroots initiatives themselves, and get the public sector to set the framework itself. And then all of a sudden, the synergies of the dynamism and the excitement of America, really our exceptionalism, comes together. And I get to see it. I've seen it. I've seen it on the ground, so I know it can work. But it really does, I think, go to this sort of Save the Children. And the Save the Children issue, When I got out, I picked one big thing to do, and it's with Save the Children. And why? It's because there are 10,000 kids who are going to die today while I'm here in Washington, D.C., and 6,000 of those could live easily, not with expensive drugs, not with heart and lung transplants, not with that stuff, but with simple things like clean water. 3,000 of those kids, if they just had access to clean water, would live. I was in Bangladesh two years ago, and with Save the Children, and those of you who've been to Bangladesh, it's an unbelievable place, and I love it. It's Dhaka, it's crowded, it's humanity. But at the hospital that I was at, and I took one of my sons, I always take one of my sons with me, even in the Sudan, even in the Nuba Mountains, I have. And Karen, my wife, hates that, but it's going to change their lives as well. In that hospital in Sudan, 1,100 patients came in with cholera, in essence cardiogenic shock, every day because of dehydration, in one hospital from cholera, lined up in the streets, canopies in the streets, and the cholera kind of comes in after that. But 1,000, they're probably there, 30 hospitals like that. All of those lives would be saved if you had clean water. So if for the children, 6,000 kids could be saved. A little bit of clean water, a little bit of vaccine, a little bit of vitamin A, a little bit of oral rehydration, a little bit of education through community health workers for maternal health. And that's it. And that's cheap stuff. It's cheap stuff. I'm a Republican. I don't like to waste money. That's cheap stuff. And it's you're accountable. It's a different way of development, a different way of aid, and we'll be out there. We're going to make a difference. We're going to keep working. Anyway, let's see. Bob, Save the Children. That's good. That's good now.
Okay. I think we're at the end of our
hour.
I'm just kidding.
Everybody needs to go to work.
Yeah, I want to, on behalf of everyone here, thank you so much for spending this hour with us. This has been a great conversation. I thank everyone here who's come. So on behalf of everyone, thank you so much.
Good. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.